Welcome to another exciting episode here at IT Pro TV.
Exciting.
I'm your host, Mike Roderick. Today we're doing our CISSP content, and specifically we've been looking at software development security. This is going to be a part two. We've already been discussing it, obviously, in part one, so if you missed that one, go back and watch that one. We're going to continue on with, again, software development security. And as always, here to help us with this is Mr. Adam Gordon. How's it going, Adam?
Good, good. Part one equals part two. That's Mike math, by the way, in case you were wondering about that.
Great.
So we're going to continue our conversations as we were discussing, and Mike led us down the path to move towards. You know, we've been talking about secure life cycles and SDLCs, and the reasons why and the importance of understanding how to build security in at every level, at every phase of development. It's very, very important. I mentioned secure early and secure often. Mike liked that one a lot. He's actually getting that printed on his business cards going forward. He'll say, Mike Roderick, edutainer, secure early, secure often, on the back.
I've already got my tattoo design.
He's got it all set up. So, you know, thinking about the idea that we need to, and it's a catchy phrase, right? And all kidding aside, it helps us to understand what the thought process of the CISSP needs to be, which is always be thinking security, right? Another good catchphrase we can rely on there. Secure early, secure often, always be thinking security, because these are important things. One of the most important things that we can do, and we've talked about the need for documentation, how good it needs to be, how important it is. One of the most important things we can do is document exactly that, what we're doing at every step in the life cycle. And to that end, to that effect, the outcome of documentation is really kind of paired with two thought processes, change and configuration management. And I've mentioned them already in the prior episode as we were setting up and talking through the phases of the SDLC, mentioned how important they are, mentioned the reasons why we need to be thinking about change management. Change management should kick in, should be a part of everything we do, just like security should kick in, be a part of everything we do from the beginning of our development efforts. If we are thinking about change and change management at every step in the SDLC, then what we're going to do is we're going to have better documentation, because we're going to be constantly assessing and looking at what the current state of something is, whatever it is, and we're going to look at what we're doing to affect that current state. And change management is all about understanding that something exists in a state, whatever that state is today, and as we impact that something through an add, a modification, a revoke, an update, whatever it may be, anything that in any way alters that current state, that known good state, as we often talk about it, then change management has to come along, kick in, and be a part of that thought process. Now, you may be sitting there thinking and saying to yourself, well, Adam, that's good, but the reality is, if we're developing something that's brand new and it doesn't exist today, then why is change management important? Maybe I don't have anything that exists. Maybe I don't have to worry about that. Well, you still do, right? Because the reality is, even though you don't have anything that exists today, you have other things, right, that are going to be impacted by the thing you're working on. And SDLCs, development life cycles, are not just about developing the product, the good, the service, the system, the software that you're working on, but it's about ultimately integrating those things, whatever that is, into the existing system, the existing service, the existing offering or software that you have. And you have those in your systems. There is something there today. It may not be something that directly relates to what we're going to do with the SDLC, but unless we can validate beyond any reasonable doubt that it will not impact in any way what the current state of the system is, the impact or the change that SDLC that you're working through will have on the current system has to be accounted for. And this is what change management is all about. It's about, obviously, generically, the idea of change. But in this regard, in this circumstance, with specificity related to this conversation, it's about not only what you're doing, but the impact of what you're doing on the existing things that are already up and running, that are in your system, that make up and affect your world. So it's about what changes you're going to introduce and what impact those changes are going to have. We've spoken before about the butterfly effect, about the idea of unintended consequence, about the idea of unmanaged and undocumented change and the negative specificity that that can have and that that can bring into, and the vulnerabilities and the threats and the risks that that can implement or introduce into your organization, either looked for or unlooked for, intended or unintended. Unintended consequences are still consequences, right? And even though we didn't mean to do something, if the outcome is, hey, that happened, then guess what? You're still responsible. So at the end of the day, whether you do it on purpose or not, you still, as the CISSP, are responsible for understanding how to manage that outcome. Due care and due diligence. We never get away from those terms. We never move away from risk. We never move away from the ideas that these systems that are under our care are feeding our management have to be monitored continuously, have to be audited regularly, have to be validated on an ongoing basis, and that anything that impacts them negatively or impacts them positively, either way, has to be documented and accounted for. It's very, very important. It's the thought process, right?
Very good, yes.
Yeah. So something to consider. I'm glad Mike agrees because if he said no, I'd be done. I have to throw in the towel.
Right?
Walk out of here, throw down the mic, and we'd be out of here. We'd be on to something else. We could talk about espresso and how to make a good espresso. It's always a favorite topic of mine.
You do make some good espresso.
I do. So think about change management. It's very, very important, right? So successful change management. What does that require? What does that entail? It entails a couple of things. First, awareness of current state, right? What it is, the as is, in other words, that we are thinking about. The current state of affairs must be well documented. If we don't know what we're doing today, if we don't know what the system is capable of, if we don't understand what's going on, how can we possibly understand what change is happening and the impact of that change? Good, bad, or indifferent, right? Because change could be good. It could be negative. It could also be value neutral. In effect, we can make a change, but nothing really happens. It just keeps going and everything's okay. But the reality is, whether change is good, bad, or value neutral, the reality of that situation is if we don't understand what the modern current state, documented as is state is, we have no idea how to measure change and no idea how to measure impact of change. So it's our responsibility to understand the current state of our systems. It's very important. So we have to understand effectively what that is. We have to communicate that effectively. We have to document that effectively. This implies continuous monitoring, implies auditability of all transactions in the system. It implies traceability of all transactions in the system. It implies visibility to everything that's going on in the system. All these things are part of a well thought through, ultimately a mature change management process. You know, you can take, and I often we'll talk to customers and students about this in classes or when I'm having meetings with them. You know, it's very easy, and I don't often say something is easy because most things are not, at least not when you get into the details, and often on the surface they may seem that way. But reality is we often find as we get good at something and we really understand how to do it well that it's not easy. It may look easy, but it's really not that easy. But understanding whether you have a good grasp of change and change management in your organization is actually a fairly straightforward and easy thought process. Not managing change, let me be clear. Mm. Managing change is complicated, but understanding whether you are doing that effectively in your organization is actually fairly straightforward and easy. It's a fairly simple litmus test. A litmus test, generically, is a test that we can use to validate an assumption. Right? If we think about saying, yes, this is like this or this is like that, we can use a litmus test, a validation test, to see whether or not that statement is true or false. We can understand whether we have a good handle on change using a fairly straightforward and simple litmus test. If our documentation is good, if our documentation speaks to our ability to manage change, we should be able to look at, understand, and see evidence of a well-formed, robust, and mature change management process in the organization. If we have a well-documented, well-thought-out, well-operating, or good and well-implemented change management process, then no change should be allowed to occur without running through that process, without documentation, and without approval. And if change has not been approved, it should never be implemented. If we can look to that process and we can look to that system and it's working, then we know that change management isn't implemented correctly. We don't know whether it's actually functioning as well as it could. We need to do more due diligence, and we need to investigate to establish that. But what we can tell on the surface is that there is a well-documented, well-understood, and implemented process that speaks to change, the impact of change, and management of change in the organization. Remember, when we come in and we do auditing work, this is one of the key things we look for as a security auditor. We're going to ask you, what kind of change management process do you have in place? Is it well-documented? Can you explain it to me? Can you show it to me? I want to see evidence of the last five changes that went through the process. Show me your change log is something an auditor may ask you. Show me your forward schedule of change, your FSC, which is effectively your projected change management schedule that goes into your next change management window or release cycle, right? That's going to effectively be up on a board somewhere in theory as a calendar that you're managing against. Now, that may be a virtual board. It may be in SharePoint as a calendar. It may be up on a whiteboard in a project manager's office. I don't care where it is, but I want to see it. You can show me a printed calendar as a page and say, well, here's the next 30 days of change schedule that we have, and this is what we've done. This is what we're going to do. I'll say, great, that's awesome. If you can't show me that, I'm going to question whether or not change management's effective in the organization. If you don't understand what that is, when I ask you, I'm going to question whether change management's effectively implemented in the organization. Now, a lot of people ask me, So, well, Adam, how do we know all that? How do we know where change lives? Who manages change? We're not really sure. We think we're doing it. We think we're good at it. But, you know, I don't know. As a security practitioner, as a security professional, as somebody that does this, you know, change is important. I get it. I know what you're saying. It's central to my world. But honestly, I'm not the one who manages it in the organization. I have this conversation all the time with customers, all the time with students. I am not responsible for it, even though I know how important it is. And the people that are, I don't really understand very well. I don't interact with them. I don't have a lot to do with them. And I'm kind of divorced. I'm separated from that whole process. And so how do I know? Right? And it's a valid question. How do you know? What you're asking, in effect, is where's my litmus test? Show me how to validate. Right? You're telling me it's easy, but show me what I can do to figure it out. So what I often talk to people about when they ask that question is where do you go to find change in the organization, right? Because if you know where to look, and not change itself, but where is change being managed is really what we're focusing on. Where do we go to find where change is and where it's being managed? If you go to where change lives, then you can find out what's there, right? You knock on the door and a change manager answers the door, pokes out their head and says, hello, how are you? I'm here to manage change. If they say that to you, right, then that's what you're looking for virtually to validate. So the question really is, where do I go to manage change, or where do I go to see change being managed in the organization? The answer, again, can be fairly straightforward or could be incredibly obtuse and complex. Let's go with the fairly straightforward version for a moment. Most organizations that are good at change management, again, most, not all, nothing is 100%, right? But most will have a PMO, a project management office, and they will have a well-defined organizational entity that is responsible for project management and all of that that goes with it. But change management is a key component of project management. And so where you often go and find change living, change being managed, and change being dealt with in an organization that's mature is through the PMO, through the project management office. And if you have an established PMO and or you have RMOs, risk management officers, a chief risk officer, CRM, right, or something like chief risk manager or a chief risk officer, CRO. They're called different things in organizations today. But we're seeing more and more that at the C level of organizations that really understand change and understand risk, that this is an established and now well-documented role that is being carved out and being dedicated as a resource. Management of change, management of risk. So you may have a chief risk officer, you may have a chief risk manager, you may have a chief change officer or change manager. You know, these are roles that exist, and they typically are tied to a PMO. They may report up under a CIO, a CTO, a CSO, a CISO laterally. They may be part of that team. They may stand separately. But ultimately, you will see change in the organization in those spheres. And if you find them, that's where you typically can go to look for change. Another place to look today, believe it or not, is something that has become more common today, is something we're hearing a lot about as a framework in an area, something called DevOps. You may have heard of DevOps, short for development operations or development slash operations, the marrying of development, SDLC kind of thought processes, a la software and system development, with operational capabilities and capacity. DevOps is an acronym or a slang, a shortening of that for general consumption. When we think about DevOps as a framework and a thought process, we think about the ideas of marrying development and operational capabilities together, and then pursuing that thought process, really focused highly on automation and central management and control of systems and processing and provisioning. And DevOps is really all about that thought process. Technology like containerization and virtualization plays a big part, as does scripting and workflow automation within the DevOps world today. But DevOps is highly hyper-focused on change and change management as well, because you can't do DevOps correctly today if you don't understand change management. And so if you see DevOps emerging in your world and you see a thought process around pursuing a DevOps framework or a DevOps thought process, you are seeing change management emerging in the organization, perhaps under a different name, under a different guise, but ultimately seeing it there as well. And that's something, you know, just to be aware of and to be thinking about, and to be thinking about the ability to be able to communicate effectively, manage to a schedule, understand risk, and manage through change is really what we're talking about, and seeing how that emerges in the organization and linking it back to the thought process of the SDLC is going to be very important for you. Remember, we're thinking about mile wide, inch deep knowledge. And we're spending a lot of time talking about change. And it's a theme like risk that we've talked about in several places across different knowledge areas within multiple episodes across the CISSP conversation we're having. That should give you some indication of the importance of the idea, but perhaps not an indication of the specificity of that idea in any one area. And what I'm trying to communicate to you without being too obtuse about it is, you know, change management, risk, these are important themes. These are themes that we can ask lots of questions about from different perspectives on an exam. And these are questions that we can talk about as CISSPs in the organization at multiple levels with different audiences for different reasons. You need to be prepared to have those conversations. You need to be prepared to answer those questions when they emerge in order to be successful. It's very important for you and important for your candidacy as a CISSP candidate in order to be successful and move on to become a CISSP and ultimately over time to take your skills and put them into practice in the real world. You know, as we continue our conversations, change management, DevOps, all those things are important. But enforcing security controls within the development environment and thinking about how we do that with regards to the discussion around what kind of methodologies we may use, what are the models, in other words, that represent the SDLCs we've been talking about. We mentioned some, but it's a good idea to bring them back up again and just quickly go through them. Mike's kindly volunteered to walk us through those models. He's going to now, I'm going to sit down for a couple of minutes, rest my feet. I got my cool socks on, so I want to give those a break real quick. We didn't get a shot of the cool socks, by the way.
We didn't yet.
No, you got to see the cool socks.
Let's see what he's
got. So the cool socks,
today.
It's kind of hard to see, but I'm rocking a pink and gray with a little brown stripe in there today. So kind of a cool little thing with the pink highlights on the bottom there, right? So starting off the new year with a cool sock. So, you know, we want to think about those and make sure we're aware not only of the cool sock options, because those are very important for well-dressed CISSPs this year as well, but what the options are from the perspective of understanding what models that we have to focus on. So things like waterfall, things like the iterative life cycle, such as RAD or JAD, right? JIT, just in time. You know, these are all models that may be important to us. So structured programming development, spiral method, clean room, these are all examples of system models or development models that follow a waterfall-like methodology. Very clearly defined steps within a phase, very clear transition from phase to phase. Output of one phase becomes input for the next. This is really what we're thinking about, and we have to have clear documentation as we move through these kinds of models. When we think about iterative development models, we think about, you know, models that are going to effectively cycle through some sort of a process and then come back and loop back around and take multiple passes at something to get it right. Things like prototyping is a good example of an iterative development model where we build a prototype, we may adjust it based on feedback, go through multiple feedback sessions, adjusting as we go iteratively, in other words, spiraling around or going through multiple cycles, and then eventually we get to a finish line where we feel comfortable, we release that, and then perhaps you'll go through that process multiple times as we continue to update. So thinking about prototyping, good example of iterative development. I mentioned RAD, I mentioned JAD, rapid application, joint application, or joint analysis development. These are RAD and JAD. Exploratory model, modified prototyping model. These are all examples of iterative development models. Would I spend a huge amount of time understanding the model types? Would I spend a huge amount of time being able to define them all? If we're not spending a huge amount of time doing that for you, it's probably not worth your investment of time to do that. But what I would suggest is that it would be helpful to have an example, a working example of one or two in the category of iterative, in the category of a waterfall-like model. Meaning, if I said to you, hey, of the list that you see on the screen, what are two examples of iterative development models? It would be good to be able to pick out the examples and know that they align themselves with iterative as opposed to with a waterfall model. But aside from that, would I spend a lot of time investing in knowing the difference between JAD and RAD from a definition standpoint? Not unless you want to become a software development engineer, in which case I would definitely want to know those, but you're going to go beyond the knowledge we're giving you here and do a lot more to become good at that. And that's going to be more than mile wide, inch deep. So just be aware of that and think through that. There's a lot of other models that exist out there. You know, keeping in mind that the model that's most appropriate for the decisions you're making about how to develop that system is the one that matches the expectations of the stakeholders and gives you the clearest path and the most likely capability to be successful. And that model choice may change program to program, project to project, system to system. So be aware of the fact that it's not going to be, oh, I always do waterfall no matter what. I always do agile no matter what. Your shop may be that way, and you may be set up, and that may be the framework that your company uses to do development through project management. And that's fine, but that means that you've adjusted your SDLC to marry it to the needs of that framework, and that framework supports the requirements that you are pushing towards and the way in which you gather them. But that doesn't mean it's the only framework out there that exists. It also doesn't mean it's necessarily the best one. It means it's the one you've settled on. And it may be the best one at the time, but there are certain projects that may benefit from a different model. And that's up to you to decide. And there's no right and wrong. But I do want to point out to you that I talk to a lot of customers that say, oh, we're agile, bottom line, that's all we do. Or we're this or we're that. We do agile scrum, which is just a derivative of agile. Or we do waterfall, straight waterfall. We do, spiral. We do clean room, whatever it is. There's many, many methods. Add car, whatever it may be. Point is, whatever you choose, if that's what you choose to do in the organization, great. But what I hate to hear is that's all we do, and that's our methodology, period, end of sentence, because not every project fits neatly into that methodology box. And there are certain projects that may not really work as well in that box. And you just have to be aware of that. It's, again, up to you from a perspective of offering the best possible guidance from a security standpoint to remind the organization that while you have established methodologies and you want to follow them, unless there's a compelling reason to the contrary, that sometimes there may be compelling reasons and you should at least entertain them. At least be aware of them. You may choose, after full disclosure, not to go down the path of change, and that's fine. But at least document the risks and associate them with the project, understand them for what they are, and then make an educated decision. Now, I know that's easy to say in conversation. I know it's hard to do in reality, and I get that. And I'm not suggesting for a minute that you should be the one that forces the uncomfortable conversation to occur every time just for the sake of planting your flag on the ground and saying, I'm a good CISSP, I did my job. That's not what being a good CISSP is about by itself. It's part of a larger thought process, larger dynamic about how to relate the needs of the organization to the realities of the security protections that we have to try to provide at every step in the process, right? Confidentiality, integrity, and availability. If it's a marginal protection add or value add by changing methodology, it's probably not worth your time and trouble. But if there's significant investment in time and effort that will be required, but the value that you're going to bring is going to equal or exceed that, it's worth at least acknowledging that and having the dialogue the dialogue inside the organization to assess whether a change in focus could actually be positive. And that's all I'm suggesting. I'm not suggesting you have to do it. I'm simply suggesting that stopping and taking the time to engage the dialogue and make sure it's happening is really what the most important thought process is. So think about that. You may be able to combine models. You may be able to change the thought process for one project, go back to it for another. There's a lot of approaches the CISSP may throw on the table and bring to bear. When we think about developing software and we think about an SDLC, we don't just think about developing the software itself, but we think about what that software will do when it's used, what kind of systems will it ultimately be connected to, as we talked about. And database management is often one of those things that comes up in this dialogue, because databases typically not only have to be developed and have to be maintained and secured, but they interact with different application front ends and different software platforms, because they typically are the back end repositories for most of the data that these software systems that we build are going to need and or use and are going to be able to communicate with. And so database management from a security standpoint becomes a very important thought process as well. So the DBMS, the database management system or structure, is important for us to at least have some passing knowledge of. We want to think about the fact that the DBMS is going to be a suite of applications or programs that ultimately allows us to be able to manage the database, manage all the constituent parts and components of it, the security, the implementation of the data model, the software that is going to implement the database itself, and the management front end that allows us to control it, set up access control, set up backup, set up all the capabilities and functionalities we need in order to be able to do this. It stores, maintains, and provides access to data using the ability to typically drive that through querying of some kind. So we have a query language associated with it as well, whether it's a structured query language or it's a different kind of query language. There's lots of different languages out there, but we ultimately want to know and think through those. So the database engine itself, the hardware platform, the application software, and the users are all elements of a DBMS, all elements of the database management system. Want to know those elements, want to identify what they are, again, four of them, no particular order. The database engine itself, the hardware platform the database will run on, application software, and then the users that are going to actually interact with the system are typically the four elements of the DBMS that we often talk about. We have different database models that we also want to be aware of. The hierarchical database model is the oldest one that typically is out there. You will come across, we probably are all familiar with it. It is going to store data in a series of records that have values associated with them in their field, and then link them through parent-child relationships in some sort of a tree as a hierarchy. This is one we're very commonly associated with. LDAP, for instance, is implemented as a directory service, typically using a hierarchical database model, more often than not. So just want to be aware of that and think about that. Network database model, another model that exists out there from a management perspective, represents the data typically in the form of a network of records. So not the network, i.e., the network we communicate across, but network is in an association, a collection of records that are effectively joined together in some way that are related to each other. Records are the equivalent of the rows in the relational model, and the record types are sets of records in that model. So want to think about the network database model. Not as common, not something we often will see. You may see this in healthcare systems, for instance, one of the places you may see a model like that. We have relational database models as well. These are based on the idea of being able to abstract data and be able to provide data through abstraction so we can see the relationships associated with it. This is a common model that most of us are familiar with. If we use modern databases today, if you've ever done any work with Access as a database or Microsoft SQL or Oracle or IBM's DB2 or Informix or any of these big databases, enterprise-level databases, things like that. If you have had any training on them, if you ever use them for anything, if you, you know, interact with them, if you use Excel to be able to pull data out of a database and do analysis on it through pivot tables and things like that, and you create tables and the relationship between them in order to drive that, you've used a relational model before, and you've seen this, you've interacted with it. Access is, Microsoft Access is predicated on the idea of a relational model. Tables are available to us. Tables or relations are what they're called. We have integrity rules. We have data manipulation agents that go into making up the relational model. So these are the working parts, the working elements of this model. When we think about a data table inside of the database. And I love talking about databases and tables, but a lot of people just aren't very comfortable with it. They don't understand a lot about it. They think they know, but you know, it's kind of a dark, scary area. You look at a table, it looks kind of weird. There's a lot of strange code in there. They don't understand all the data and how to interact with it. So, you know, a lot of times say, well, it's better left to the professionals. Let the DBAs, the database analysts or administrators, deal with that. And you're absolutely right. If they're experts at that, that's what they should do. But again, as a CISSP, we have to have working knowledge of these things, at least enough to understand what we can and cannot do comfortably, and the ability to then make a determination and say, hey, you know what, Mike's the DBA expert. Let me give this job to Mike. Mike's going to come in and query our data for us, help us understand the structure of the data table, understand the moving parts, the attributes of a table, and then he's going to help us to understand how to secure them. I'm going to help manage that process as a CISSP. I'm going to give Mike some guidance and direction. Mike's going to give me the facts, in other words, going to say, hey, this or that, this is what's going on, this is what's here. Now I need some policy and, you know, strategic guidance, Adam, overall, to tell me what the business objectives are. How secure do we want to make this thing? Who should be able to see it? Who should interact with it? How can we query data? What should we show when we do query data? Should we obfuscate? Should we tokenize? Do we support that function in the database? We may or may not. Can we encrypt data fields in a table? Get asked that all the time as well. Actually, we just had an interesting conversation with a customer of mine that's looking to do some System Center work, right? And System Center is a really popular program. A lot of people use it or generically use programs like System Center for systems management across the enterprise. You could be using HP OpenView or IBM Tivoli, whatever you may use, it doesn't matter. But programs like that, asset management programs generically. And they asked me specifically, hey, do we support field manipulation and do we support, more importantly, encryption of individual data tables and, more importantly, the fields within them for System Center? And specifically for System Center Config Manager within that particular thought process. And so, you know, we had a conversation about that. And the problem is we may or may not, depending on the databases that are used, in this case, obviously, Microsoft SQL, used to implement. But generically, we may or may not support that. So we have to be thinking about that, right? Want to think about the fact that attributes are going to be important for us to understand with regards to database management and a relational model. An attribute is going to correspond to a column in a table. When we think about table structure, we often refer to attributes as being the columnar values, where we think about the tuple of a table corresponding to a row. And so we want to be able to think about columns and rows in a table, but we also want to call them by their appropriate names in the relational database model. Attributes equal columns, tuples, T-U-P-L-E, tuple. It's fun to say. Say it with me, Mike. Tuple. Tuple. Right? Tuple. A tuple equals a row. We want to make sure we understand attributes equal columns, tuples equal rows. That is important for you to know. If you are going to be answering questions at some point in the future, primary keys, we often hear about those and know what the, hopefully know what those are. Primary key is going to be the guaranteed method of pinpointing an individual tuple, in other words, IE. It's the only way to properly and authoritatively reference a row in a table and specify that that is the row or the specificity that we need to identify that row. It's what a primary key guarantees for us. That's used effectively to identify, you know, what data we need to key off of, in effect, or specify in that particular table. And then a foreign key simply represents the relation of the table that we are identifying a primary key into another table somewhere else and how we join those tables and refer to that row in the other table by specifying we have a foreign key, which is effectively the value that represents a resource or a reference, rather, to an entity. I'm just reading the formal definition. Foreign key. Value that represents a reference to an entry in some other table. What we mean by that effectively is that when we use a foreign key in table B, we are effectively referencing an entry in table A. And we're using the foreign key to reference that from table A. Table A would have a primary key associated with it to reference the row that we need. The foreign key would reference table A, but from table B. In effect, we want to make sure we understand how these things connect together. So want to have a good sense, good understanding of that. We've mentioned SQL. We've mentioned structured query languages generically as a way to communicate with databases within the DBMS. You know, the main components of databases that often are going to use a structured query language will be schemas, tables, and views. And we just want to understand generically that a schema is the blueprint, the design document. In effect, if you want to think of it as the plan that lays out the database and tells us how it's going to be structured, tables are where we actually store data. Generically, they're holding containers. And views are going to be how we actually interact with data. They're the way in which we see as end users what the data is and how it's represented to us based on the schemas, the structure, and based on the tables, the holding containers where data actually lives. Data may be very varied and very broad in the table. We may only see a very small select group of that data in a view because we are constraining, in effect, filtering down that view from a security standpoint or a management standpoint in order to allow the user to interact with data they need but not see data that they should not be exposed to. Remember, confidentiality and integrity have to be enforced through these kind of mechanisms. And a view, a constrained interface, is a good way to think about enforcing confidentiality and integrity controls. We have a bunch of different, you know, languages that exist within the database management system, but SQL generically, structured query language, is going to be a real important thought process for you to think about.
All right, Adam, and there's some other database models we have to at least be familiar with, right?
There are, absolutely. So, you know, object-oriented database models, for instance, we store data as objects within the model. It's a relatively new one. It's one you probably have heard of. You may have heard of object-oriented programming, for instance, which plays off this general idea. We also have database interface languages. You know, how do we actually interact with the data? What are the languages we use to do that? Things like ODBC, which is probably fairly common and probably, I would think, well-known to most of you, even though you may not necessarily think of it as a database interface language, but we often think of it as just the way we connect to databases and how we pull data across. But ODBC is actually a language we use to interface with databases. JDBC, the Java equivalent, Java Database Connectivity also. XML, OLEDB, which is one that's kind of an oldie but a goodie, object linking and embedding, and also ADO, Active X Data Objects, which is a Microsoft proprietary one, but usually is used in Microsoft systems. These are all database interface languages. And we also have to think about APIs when we think about database management systems as well. Your application programming interfaces, how do we effectively, from a vendor perspective, are we given the rights and the access to interact with their software, in this case their database, and pull data out and interact with it at the application level? This is how we write code effectively that links to the database and allows us to access functionality and features through the vendor's interface. So APIs also become very important when we think about DBMSs.
All right, Adam, again, a lot of great information there, and I know we've got more to go, but we're going to have to call it on this one. We are out of time. Great look at, you know, change management. We looked at some of our development models, and in the end there, a really good look at database management and how what we need to be familiar with there. So remember, if you guys want to attend one of Adam's classes live, just shoot us an email here at cadam@itpro.tv. Signing off for now, I'm Mike Roderick.
I'm a tuple.
And we'll see you next time.
Take care.